see? I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Front Noir.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I got a feeling you're being cheated.
It is Thursday, January 23rd, 2014. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not in the literal nor metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building, but instead in the Hyatt, is this a Regency? Hotel in Washington, D.C., from the Families USA Health Action 2014 conference. I am here until tomorrow interviewing different healthcare advocates, different policymakers, some lawyers on some of the continuing cases challenging the constitutionality of the statutory execution of the Affordable Care Act. And collecting some interviews, and we'll be playing some of those over the days to come. On today's program, Wendell Potter, the former Cigna insurance executive, author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider, speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans, and author of the latest Obamacare, What's in It for Me?, and also a senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity. He will be joining me just in moments on this program. We'll be covering a lot of other news as I am sequestered in this hotel. I will say that it was incredibly cold on my trip down. I took the train, and apparently the one of the doors to the cabins was frozen open, and I literally, I think I was on the verge of frostbite. I think I almost, how apropos it would have been that I would have lost my toes in a health emergency on the way to a healthcare conference. But fortunately, I am here. Hopefully, I've got the tech right, and you are hearing me as I speak. We'll make adjustments as we go on. I will be able to take phone calls today and your IMs. Like I say, don't have too many stories to go over, and we're collecting interviews. But now I want to introduce to the program who I've actually we've interviewed before here, Wendell Potter. He, like I say, is the former Cigna insurance executive who had quite a storied, I guess, career as an insurance executive. At one time, I believe, sort of not shadowing, but certainly sort of investigating Michael Moore, if I remember correctly. And also author of a new book, Obamacare, What's in It for Me? What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act. Welcome to the program, Wendell.
Thanks, Sam. It's good to be here.
Now, and Wendell, if you could just tip the mic just a little bit towards... Yeah, there we go. Thanks. That's great. So, Wendell, before we get to what's in it for me in terms of Obamacare, let's, you know, one of the, over the years we've spoken quite a bit, and I think one of the things that you've talked to me about, and have said other places obviously as well, but that has always resonated with me, was that The insurance industry prior to the Affordable Care Act was in some ways an already failed business model. Will you just remind us of that, just to set the context of what the Affordable Care Act has and has not done in some ways?
Right. Yeah, it was a failed model, and to a certain extent, the Affordable Care Act gives the insurance industry a new lease on life. And here's what I mean by that. To make money in the past, the insurance industry has excluded people from coverage, and so year after year, they would insure fewer people. As we get older as a country, we have pre-existing conditions, and more of us are not able to afford the coverage that they've been selling, or they've been blackballing us because of pre-existing conditions. And the universe of companies that are able to that's been able to offer coverage has been shrinking. So the base of customers for insurance companies has been going down because of the way the society is aging and just their own business practices. It's not a sustainable business model, and so that's one of the reasons why, behind the scenes, they were actually supporting health care reform. Now, the distinction here is that they wanted it on their own terms, and they don't like the consumer protections in the law. But they recognized, the senior executives recognized, that they were in a business that was not sustainable. They had to have some external reforms.
In some ways, I mean, they were going through sort of an industry-wide death spiral of their own.
Absolutely right. They were.
I mean, how long have they known this? I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, you're talking about insurance companies. They have nothing but actuaries there, right?
That's right, yeah.
So they must have seen this coming for quite a while.
They have. But some of them have been able to kind of insulate that or keep the gig going because a lot of them specialize in working with large employers that are self-insured. That's the way the industry has been going. But we're not minting big companies anymore like that, and so the way they would grow is they call it stealing market share. They just try to steal a client from each other. That's the way that they were able to grow their membership or to take it away from smaller health plans.
So any given company may do better in any given year, but the industry as a whole was not expanding.
That's
and
right.
not doing anything to sustain the amount of companies, I guess, that were in it.
That's right, and that's why every year we saw the number of uninsured continue to go up till we had almost 51 million just before the Affordable Care Act was passed, and the number of people with insurance began to a steady decline. So when you have that dynamic, you know, that is a death spiral. I mean, that's an industry in decline, and something had to happen.
All right, and so and that thing that had to happen could either, theoretically, it could either benefit insurance companies, or it could have basically made them more or less extinct as we know them now. I mean,
Right. Had
we gone to some form of single payer where they would have maybe just functioned to administer that insurance for the government.
Right.
As opposed to sort of originated, I guess.
That's right.
They would have been. It would have been a different world for them.
It would have been a very different world, and they, you know, the world that they know is the one that they want to perpetuate, or as close to it as they possibly can, and so that's why they were able to help shape the Affordable Care Act to a certain extent. They certainly were able to make sure that there was no serious conversation about single payer, at least that Congress was not going to be really serious about passing a single payer bill, and they worked Congress and they worked the White House to make sure that at least the law that was passed was based on the existing insurance system.
All right, so just so we have that context, that's always, I think, an important reminder for the audience and for myself, frankly. I mean, that knowledge of where the insurance companies were prior to this, I think, is really important to understand why we ended up getting the Affordable Care Act in some ways. And people can argue as to whether or not both the politics and, you know, what could have happened legislatively or what was the perfect being the enemy of the good, or the slightly better than status quo, whatever. But let's leave those aside. I think that's an important context in which to see this and move to where. I don't want to quite get to what Obamacare, what's in it for me. Let's take the temperature first, as it were, of Obamacare. One of the most interesting things from my perspective about the tremendous controversy on the private exchanges and how they're doing and how many uninsured are now getting insurance is that we are still talking about a relatively, in terms of the size of the country, a relatively small amount of people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So give us a sense of what's going on there. I've heard recently in the past couple of days that less than a third or about a third of the people who have signed up through exchanges didn't have insurance.
Right.
Where is that relative to what was projected?
Well, it doesn't surprise me at all, because keep in mind that a lot of people who did have insurance and who bought it on the individual market, that's, you know, as you said, it's a fairly small market. About 15 million Americans have been buying coverage on their own. They've been able to do it. They've had the means to do it. But a lot of those folks now realize that they can get coverage through the exchanges and in many cases qualify for a tax credit or a subsidy. So, of course, they're going to shift to buy coverage there because they can save some money.
And a certain percentage of them had their policies canceled, which, frankly, also would have happened more or less anyway.
It would have happened anyway.
Because I think only 17% of people have the same policy for more than 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. It happens every year in and year out. My son, before the Affordable Care Act was passed, got a notice in 2009, at the end of 2009, that his policy was not going to be renewable. They were canceling it, and they did that because they wanted to get him out of that plan. It wasn't as profitable as it used to be. They wanted to shift him into a higher deductible plan, and the way to do that was to just not let his plan be available anymore. He had no choice if he wanted to stay insured to that company to shift to a different plan. That happens year in and year out. People now are, you know, they were up in arms about the letters that went out this year and blaming it on Obamacare. It would have happened anyway.
Right. And those plans, the insurance companies realize that the plans are not profitable because different maladies or what is that? I mean, what may, or is it just we've designed this plan, we thought it was going to go one way and it ended up going another way, and is that what happened?
Yeah, they do employ armies of actuaries, but they don't always get it exactly right. And sometimes a plan attracts people who are using their coverage more than they anticipated. So it becomes less profitable. And sometimes they actually lose money on certain plans because you just can't control that precisely. When that happens, they want to ditch a plan, or they see an opportunity to move someone into a higher deductible plan that enables them to shift more of the cost of care from them to their customers. Also, though, and the Affordable Care Act did result in some of those cancellations because a lot of those plans had very meager benefits.
Right. They didn't meet the minimum standards of what actually constitutes insurance.
Right. And so people were paying good money for lousy insurance in many cases, but they just weren't aware of it. They didn't know what they were buying in many cases or what little protection they would have if they got sick or injured.
Right. You don't know that the what the response time for the fire truck is until you have a fire.
That's
right.
That's exactly
what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And you know, one thing during the course of the very contentious debate about a public option, I recall being on certain email lists where sort of left-wing or centrist technocrats were saying, you know, the left is ridiculous for making such a stink out of something that would cover so few people, would actually really involve so few people. And there's some truth to that because we're talking a subset of 15, 16 million people across the country who would actually enroll in a public option. It would compete for those same dollars, I guess, theoretically, state to state. But the importance of the public option at that time was more important than the direct benefit to the 5 million, let's say, people who may have signed up for it. It would have simply been basically a pilot program in some respects, right?
It would have been, and it would have grown over time. And here's why. Yes, that market total, as before the law was passed, was about 15 million people. But again, about 51 million people didn't have insurance, so they theoretically are new customers for the individual market. So the pie would have been bigger suddenly, and those people who are uninsured in many cases can get subsidies that enables them to buy coverage. So
that 51 million, does that include, do you know the breakdown? I mean, that was the figure before the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
What was the breakdown of Medicaid eligible under the Affordable Care Act expansion? Presume it happens in 50 states. 400% of poverty.
Right.
No, excuse me, 133% of poverty.
Yeah.
What was the breakdown? In other words, how many millions would have been eligible for Medicaid and then the rest ostensibly buy on the exchanges?
A significant percentage, and I don't recall the exact percentage, but we're talking about several million people. And even with the states that are just half the states expanding, we're seeing that several million people already are signed up for coverage, but probably would be at least, I would say, 12 to 13, if not more, million people
would have been
Medicaid eligible.
So we're talking about then a remaining about 30, 35 a million people. So when we look at where the exchanges are now, like I say, we're back to one third of those are people who did not have insurance. What accounts for is those remaining, and I don't know what the figure would be, is it 20 million, 25 million who don't have insurance? Are they just reluctant to buy it? They're not going on the exchanges? They've decided they'll take the penalty? Do we have a sense of?
I think it's a mix of all of that. You're going to find a lot of people who just do not think they need insurance. I think they're in a minority, but some people think they can get by. They didn't need insurance last year. They didn't get sick. They didn't get hurt, so they're going to gamble that they'll have another good year. It is a gamble. That's the sad thing, because we're gambling with our lives and our incomes, because if we do get sick and we have a big hospital bill, we can be forced into bankruptcy or lose our home. So it's a huge gamble.
I mean, at the moment, frankly, it doesn't seem like it's that huge of a gamble in the sense that, okay, I'm going to take the $90 or penalty on my tax rebate, or what is it, 1% maybe of income?
It's one or the other. Yeah.
And if I do get sick, that's the time I'll sign up for health insurance, I guess, right?
Well, it is, although the open enrollment ends at the end of March this year for 2014 to be eligible for, to avoid the tax.
So you got to wait until the next open enrollment, which will come, what, in January of 2015?
It starts toward the end of this year. I can't remember exactly the date that they've set.
So you're just gambling, I hope I don't get hit by a bus until the end of the year.
Right.
You know, I guess if you have a sort of a chronic or terminal disease, that may buy you a little more time.
It will. But some people do that even if they have employer-sponsored coverage. And employers have an open enrollment period. You have X number of days to sign up for coverage that is effective, usually January the 1st, but it can be other times of the year. And if you don't sign up, you're not going to get coverage unless you have a so-called life-changing event. You can get divorced or married or move or something like that that constitutes a life change or a significant lifestyle change. And it's the same with the Affordable Care Act. I mean, you've got a window of time to sign up, and you can't sign up after that until the next open enrollment period.
All right, so let's move to the other part of the equation, which has been the Medicaid expansion. To the extent that we have, I guess, not half the states, but maybe a third of the states have expanded their Medicaid. I mean, we have a third that are holdouts.
Yeah.
I've seen, well, on some level, that's a big success story, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, in the Medicaid expansion, I think 25 states in the District of Columbia have agreed to expand. Some of the ones that are not are some pretty big states, though. Florida and Texas and even my state of Pennsylvania.
Wait, so we have half of the states have not expanded their Medicaid.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that many.
Yeah.
That's more than anybody anticipated, even after the court case.
Absolutely. It absolutely is. And it's astonishing, but we had this quirk in 2010 of a lot of Republicans taking control of state houses and governor's offices. And so consequently, they see this as a political issue, and they have blocked expansion in those states. In Virginia, we're seeing that the new Democratic governor there, Terry McAuliffe, is looking to expand, wants to try to expand it. But when it was in a Republican control, there was not in the cards.
So we're talking about 7 million, 8 million people maybe who have been denied the Medicaid benefits, which is a much, much bigger story
than anybody
who's gotten their insurance canceled or anything.
It's a truth. And you were talking about states that have some have sizable populations, and some very poor states, regrettably, that have high percentages of people who would otherwise be eligible for Medicaid just can't get it.
And now I'm also seeing reports, though, that there are an increasing number of doctors who are not taking the added Medicaid patients or accepting, you know, because they just aren't basically opting into the system. What is your take on that?
It's true. A lot of doctors already don't take Medicaid patients. They're not obligated to do that. It's different on the Medicare program. Far more doctors participate in Medicare than Medicaid because reimbursements in most states for Medicaid are lower. And to be quite honest, I know this to be the case, that a lot of doctors don't want to have low-income people in their waiting rooms. It's not only just a matter of reimbursement. They just want their patient mix to be a bit different. And it's a shame. We don't also have enough doctors to start with. And so it's going to be a problem for some. I do think, though, that we're not going to see, I don't think, a huge access problem. I think that there are going to be some other innovations, some other ways that people can get care, whether it's going to a community clinic or a place where you can get treated with a nurse practitioner, something like that.
So, I mean, how do, from a policy standpoint, how do you deal with a lack of doctors who are willing to take these Medicaid patients?
Well, you've got to, at some point, you've got to turn to, are the states going to step up to do something in terms of increasing their share of the pay for
reimbursement rates doctors.
Yeah, that's right.
Because the federal government gives a baseline reimbursement rate, and states can augment that.
That's right.
If they're in the position to do so.
Yeah.
How many states? I mean, are there a lot of states that do that now?
A lot of states do. Not everyone, by any means. It varies from state. States have a lot of autonomy in the Medicaid program, for sure.
And then the issue of, I guess, a lack of general practitioners, you're anticipating will be that void will be filled by sort of, I guess, medical entrepreneurship.
It will be, I think. I think we're going to see, we're not going to see much more reform out of this town for a long time to come, in my view. You will see reform at the state level. In some states, like Vermont, like in Massachusetts, and now moving beyond where they were to try to look at how they can control cost now that they've got most of their citizens covered. You're going to see a lot of innovation at the private sector. You'll see clinics, more clinics in Walmarts and Walgreens and other places like that. That'll be staffed by nurse practitioners and other clinicians, even just nurses that can treat a lot of people who have, you know, relatively minor illnesses.
Right.
We'll see a lot of innovation in the private sector.
Let's talk also, do you have any sense of how the co-ops are doing? I mean, one of the features of the Affordable Care Act was seed money for nonprofit co-op. Essentially, nonprofit insurance companies, not government run in terms of like a political, like a public option, but nonprofit insurance companies. And I believe There was seed money for 24 of them in maybe 22 states. I can't remember.
That's very close to what.
And I know that some of the extra seed money was lost during the fiscal cliff deal.
That's right.
That quietly that stuff went away and nobody talked about it.
That's right.
But do you have a sense of how those nonprofits are doing? I mean, it's
mixed around the country, and once again, it depends on whether or not they were able to price their premiums in a competitive way. In some states, I've heard that some of the dominant players were pricing aggressively. In other words, they were lowering their prices just so that
to drive those nonprofits out of the business.
Yeah.
You know, like the I guess sort of the Walmart store.
That's right. So you it's exactly right. So you're seeing that in some places where I think the co-ops are struggling. It's not happening everywhere. In some other states, they seem to be very competitive and are attracting quite a number of the people who are enrolling through the exchanges. I think that they'll have some staying power. You can't underprice forever.
Right.
So I think if they can last through this, if they can get through this year, and most of them should because they've got money loaned to them. This was a loan. It wasn't a gift from the federal government. I think it can be good.
Are they eligible for things like funds that are available to the private insurers, like through risk corridors?
They are.
Just to let people know, will you explain the concept of risk corridors?
Right.
And there's a couple other provisions which essentially say to these insurance companies, we know this transition is going to be difficult.
Yeah.
In the event that your profitability drops below a certain level, we will subsidize because everybody's getting used to a new system and can't price this thing.
Exactly right. It's a brand new system. No one knew or knows even yet what the mix of people are going to be. And so when they were writing the Affordable Care Act, they set aside some money for the first 3 years, or beginning this year through 2016, to adjust risk. And it's called the three R's, the risk adjustment, risk corridor. Reinsurance is part of the mix as well, too. And they all come together to take into consideration that some health plans will probably get older and sicker customers than others. And if that indeed is the case, to keep them from going in the red, the government put together this fund to offset that for the first 3 years. And with the assumption that after 3 years, the marketplace would begin to settle down and the insurance companies would know more about what the marketplace looks like and could price their products differently based on what the real world is. But we didn't know what the real world was going into this.
Right. And so I want to get to, presumably, have we covered much of what's in it for me in terms of Obamacare, or should we, this is the title of your new book, What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act. Have we covered, is there stuff that we've left out at this point?
I can talk about how I approached this and why I wrote the book in the first place.
Please.
There's been so much misinformation about this law, and it continues, and it will continue certainly in 2014 because it's the midterm election year.
Right.
And those who don't like the Affordable Care Act will, if they think they can, gain some political points by continuing to defame it, demean it, and to mislead people.
And I should say that, you know, based on conversations that we've had in the past, you're not you're certainly not an Obamacare apologist.
Absolutely not.
You were not doing cartwheels over this. It's safe to say.
But I'm a former journalist, and what galls me is the fact that the mainstream media has not done a very good job of, in my view, helping people to understand this law. And many of them don't think that's their responsibility, that they're here to report the politics of it. And okay, I get that. I used to be a reporter in this town, too, so I understand that. But in the absence of that, and frankly, the administration, I don't think, has done a bang-up job either of explaining what's in this law for people. I saw an opportunity and a need to try to explain in some simple terms what the law is and how it affects people. And as I was looking into this, and I knew it from having read the book, but as I've been following this since the law was passed, it does affect every one of us. And it benefits every one of us in ways that we just, in many cases, don't stop to realize. And I used myself and my immediate family, my wife, my 26-year-old daughter, my 30-year-old son, my 89-year-old mother, some cousins of mine, one of whom is a Tea Party member in Tennessee, some people I know who own their own business. I just take various people who kind of represent this country and say, this is how it affects each one of us, and how we are protected in many ways from the abuses of the industry in the past, and how this law can hopefully make coverage more secure and, in many cases, more affordable for people.
So, for instance, your 26-year-old daughter, she's been on your plan,
yeah,
up until very recently.
That's right.
And instead, 2 years ago, she would have had to have been on her own plan.
Absolutely.
So she left college or left your home.
And that's
your
what
30-year-old son gets all the benefits of pre-existing no pre-existing conditions,
yeah,
guaranteed issue, no rescission,
yeah,
actually having a legitimate, knowing what he's buying, essentially.
That's exactly
when he's buying,
right,
the health insurance.
Yeah. And he now has a job that offers benefits, but he didn't in his first job.
Right.
So anyone in his age category who works for a small business, and many of them, many young people do, a lot of those don't offer coverage. And now they can have the assurance of knowing they can get coverage. And many people starting out don't make very much money. And so a lot of them are qualifying for tax credits or subsidies. My mother, who's 89, has been on Medicare for a long time, but she's had to pay a lot of money out of her own pocket for medications because of that
donut hole is closed.
And it's closing. She's not having to pay as much out of her own pocket for medications as she was. And my Tea Party cousin lives in Tennessee, and he's a farmer. Farmers have been really discriminated against. They're small business people. They don't have the benefit of getting an employer-subsidized plan. So coverage for them has been very expensive in the past, and expensive also because of what they do. Farmers have been charged more in the past. Insurance companies charge more because of people's occupations,
right,
not just because of their age or their gender or their health status. But if you're a farmer or a nurse, you often have been discriminated against in the past. Those days are gone. People don't realize that. Those are some of the important protections in the law.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that there's three big stories, ultimately. One is, you are getting more people, you're expanding Medicaid to the extent,
right,
that states will allow. Two is that another, I guess, 5% of the country has a new way of getting health insurance through the private exchanges,
yeah,
which, for the most part, the vast majority of them will find that it's less expensive, including the subsidies. And the third is, which applies to everybody, is a new regulatory regime,
yeah,
which says that this product actually has to do what you think it was doing,
yeah,
but weren't aware of its failure unless you were sick prior to buying it or attempting to buy it or got sick once you had it.
That's exactly right. You're protected from the junk that a lot of people bought. And also, we're not locked into our jobs. A lot of people have...
There's portability now.
Yeah, there's true portability. And I use my wife in that instance. We've been thinking about moving to another state. She's had a job, and our insurance has been through her employer. She's been kind of locked into that. That's not the case anymore. We have some freedom that we didn't have before.
That's not real freedom. Real freedom, Wendell, is not to be able to leave a job that you don't want. Real freedom is to have none of this meddling in your contract.
You are so right. But we're inching closer to freedom.
Let's talk about Vermont. Yeah. Because this, I think, for those of us who are who believe that a single payer is the way that we need to go to ultimately control costs across the board, where it's where you begin to bring some rationality to the way that the supply, the suppliers charge. Because that's the only way, really, to control the cost of medicine, which is really the primary driver of the cost of health insurance and the cost of medicine. I know you're up talking to the people in Vermont. Are you you consulting? What are you?
Do some consulting, but it's pretty much free consulting. The advocates up there don't have a lot of money. The other side has quite a bit of money. The insurance industry doesn't want this to keep to go forward, so they'll be throwing a lot of money at Vermont as we in the next couple of years to try to kill this from ever happening.
Tell us what the status is. This is under the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
There's a lot of latitude for states to basically develop their own scheme.
Beginning in 2017.
Okay. So, I mean, tell us what parameters a state can do.
Well, they can go pretty far. They can't go backwards. They can't, whatever they do, they have to be able to make sure that it doesn't have an adverse effect on the number of people insured. So they can't implement things that takes coverage away from people or has an adverse effect on the cost of care to the government in particular. So that means that it'll either be Obamacare going forward or something that goes beyond the Affordable Care Act. And certainly Vermont is doing that, and some other states are looking to do that as well, too. In Vermont, 2 years ago, the legislature passed a bill that the governor supported to enact or to start the first single-payer system in this country. It's sort of like what happened in Canada. Canada's had a single-payer system now for several years, but it didn't start in Ottawa. It started in Saskatchewan, in one of the provinces. And we're following the same thing here, possibly. We're starting in one of our fairly, one of our smaller states. And Saskatchewan is a relatively smaller province in Canada. The thing is, the state can't enact it or get it going immediately. The Affordable Care Act says no state can go much beyond the Affordable Care Act until 2017, and then they can get waivers to go considerably further if they want to, and Vermont wants to. Now, what the governor has to do and the legislature has to do is figure out how to finance it, how to pay for the single payer system, and that's going to be. It's going to be interesting times in Vermont.
Well, I want to get into to that aspect of what's being debated, what is being contemplated, how it would be actually executed.
Yeah.
But it's contingent upon this waiver in 2017.
Yeah.
Let's, for the moment, imagine that President Christie, from his jail cell. Is directing his head of human services, health and human services, to don't accept the waiver, don't let him go any further, and the Secretary of Health and Human Services now gotten used to the idea that an imprisoned former governor is the president, and so they listen to that directive. Is that possible?
I mean, it is possible.
Aside from the whole prison thing and the words Chris Christie, which are not possible, but it is possible that the waiver would just not be granted.
It's absolutely possible, and that gets into something just a bit off topic here, but. While the insurance companies like a lot about the Affordable Care Act because it gives them a new revenue stream, some new customers, they don't like the new consumer protections, and they sure don't want a state to have a single-payer system.
Right.
So a lot about what's going on and where the money from the insurance company PACs are going, they're going to Republicans because they want to have Congress to be controlled by Republicans, and they'd love to have a Republican control the White House because you control HHS and all the regulatory structure, and that would be just a godsend for the insurance industry, but it could be a nightmare for the rest of us. But that's what their end game is to have control of this town by those who are friendly to their interest, and that could shut down the single payer movement in Vermont or anywhere else for that matter.
Okay, so the the legislature, the governor signed off on the idea of single payer, and now what is happening? The legislator committees are trying to determine the best way to finance this. Where are we going to raise the taxes, essentially, to finance this? And these are winding through the Senate and the Assembly.
It will be in this year. There will be discussions about how best to finance it. In 2015, next year, they actually have to decide how are they going to do this, how they're going to pull it off, and that's where the war of words will be played out. It can be and probably will be cheaper to go to a single payer system than what they have now, and if people can understand that instead of their paying premiums to an insurance company, the equivalent would go to the state, which would be the single payer, and probably an existing insurance company, probably Blue Cross of Vermont, would be the entity that would administer it, just like private insurance companies administer the current Medicare program around the country. But the insurance industry doesn't want that to happen because that would signal the beginning of the end of their reign over the health insurance.
You don't want that experiment going live and people starting to go living upstate New York, looking over at Vermont and going, hey, what's going on here?
That's right.
So now, I mean, from your perspective, what is the, what is considered the best way to finance it? I mean, is it, obviously, there's going to be a tax. I mean, do you have a sense? Are there economists out there, healthcare economists out there, who have sort of come up with the best way to the sort of the best practices for something like this?
You know, when you look abroad, often France comes up at the top in terms of quality measures, in terms of patient satisfaction, and the way they do it in France, it's not the classic or pure single payer system that Canada has, but still most of the money is collected by the government. They do have insurance companies that compete, but largely on service, not so much on cost. Health insurance is a real commodity in France, far more than it is here, but we're heading in that direction. But people do have some choice. They can sign up for the equivalent of a nonprofit health insurance plan. That's the other thing about France and most of the other countries that have competing insurance companies. They operate on a nonprofit basis. And there's not much differentiation between them, but there is some.
But in terms of tax policy, I mean, is there a sense out there that the best way to do it is simply we're going to have our own statewide Social Security FICA tax?
Essentially, yes.
Like, is it going to be a payroll tax? Is it going to be?
And that is the debate in Vermont, and probably it will come down to yes, a payroll tax is the way to go. And again, you have to get into people's heads for them to understand that it's not just this big tax increase. They no longer will be paying a premium if they can equate a premium with a tax.
Right, and of course you could say like we're going to do mandatory premiums for this, but then you'd run afoul maybe of the Supreme Court.
Well, that's right.
That's right. And you have the right to tax. You don't have the right necessarily to force people to buy a product.
So all eyes will be on Vermont more than they have been. I don't think there is a lot of people are aware of what progress they've made, but it's going to be rough sledding to get where they want to wind up. I think they can do it.
Right. This is not a fait accompli by any stretch.
But it's not. Absolutely not.
And I know, or at least I've read a little bit, that at least one candidate in the Massachusetts gubernatorial race, I think in the Democratic primary, Don Berwick, has sort of floated this idea that Massachusetts could do it too. Is that right?
I know Don, and I know that Don never was confirmed as head of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services because he said something favorable about the system in the UK several years ago. But I think Massachusetts could conceivably move that way. They already are looking now at cost containment measures that are pretty far-reaching. And once again, I think they're leading the country. And Don is a serious contender for the governorship.
And is Massachusetts a good candidate because they have already been in the system? I mean, my understanding is that the Affordable Care Act, at least in terms of its execution, has sort of messed things up a little bit in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's been resolved or what. And, you know, there was obviously a huge, I mean, it was a big failure of execution.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that failure is going to resonate really more than, you know,
yeah,
whatever, 6, 12, 18 months. But is Massachusetts particularly well suited to go to single payer, or is it doesn't make a difference?
I don't know that it makes a difference. I mean, it's like Vermont. It has a fairly significant population of progressive thinkers who are more inclined to consider it in the first place, and some pretty, I would call them, enlightened policymakers and regulators who understand the importance of getting the cost out of the system, and our multi-payer system doesn't do that. As long as you're going to have multiple payers, you're going to have waste in the system. And so they're pretty far along in Massachusetts to have an understanding of that.
And I guess they also have a more educated populace in terms of the notion of having mandatory coverage.
That's right. That's right.
And so there are... I get a question on my IM. Is there anything that stops insurance companies from changing Obamacare policies by downgrading benefits next year?
Well, benefits, probably not. One of the things that's in the news quite a bit and will continue to be is the networks of physicians and hospitals that are available to people in the plans on the exchanges in particular. Because this is brand new, they're wanting to make sure that they're able to control costs as much as possible. So they're, in many cases, having what they refer to as narrow networks, not as many options to choose from of doctors and hospitals. We'll see that. That's not the same as having fewer benefits or reduced benefits. But you'll see.
So the narrow networks is basically we're not going to offer as many choices in terms of doctors here,
right,
because we are trying to be. We're trying to err on the side of, I mean, it's not directly a benefit, but it is sort of a benefit, right? Or is it an option? And then, so theoretically, do they save money per se by having a narrower network, or is it just a more cautious approach?
It is some of both. It's a cautious approach at a time when they're just trying to figure out this new marketplace. And with a smaller network, they're able to send their customers to physicians and hospitals that they're able to negotiate better rates with. Now, some health plans, like in Philadelphia, where I'm from, where I live now, they're having a lot of the plans are tiered networks. I mean, most of the hospitals are in the plan, but if you want to get the best coverage, you go to tier one.
Right.
And if you...
So you get a silver plan instead of a bronze plan, or you get a platinum plan instead of a silver plan,
yeah.
I guess.
You've got choices, and you can go to the best name hospital, but you might pay more than another hospital in the network that probably has a very good quality hospital, but might not be the marquee name.
Right, and they're just cutting down their risk margin.
That's right. That's what's going on.
In that respect.
Yeah.
And there's a chance that might improve down the road because it's not a question of profitability for them, right, necessarily.
Yeah.
It could be just simply a question of trying to protect their downside when they see after a while there is no downside.
Yeah.
Then they open up that network because they want to compete with other products on the exchange.
Right, and you're already seeing that in Philadelphia. A lot of the hospitals that started out in being in Tier 3 have come back with saying, we want to be in Tier 1, and we'll do what we can, so they'll reduce their rates. So to a certain extent, it's having the intended results of at least lowering prices a bit. And I think that we will, this is not unlike what happened several years ago when we had the employers were moving more and more people into HMOs. That took a lot of choice away from people, and there was a backlash against it. But we've had some history there. Insurers ultimately began to open their networks up again. But you'll see some pushback from consumers. But on the other hand, a lot of people who've not had insurance in the past period are going to be willing to accept a plan with a narrow network, knowing that they've got access to at least some care.
Right, because it's wider than they had before.
Wider than what they did, exactly.
In that sense. And what are the problems? I mean, you mentioned Philadelphia. What are the problems in terms of... In rural counties, my understanding is that there's instances where we're not seeing the options on the exchanges in some cases, people who need access to health insurance more than anybody else.
Yeah, it's true. It's different from around in places around the country. You've got some places like Alabama. There is one health insurer that's so dominant that there aren't many others who are willing to come into that space to compete. And that's the case in a lot of places, not because of Obamacare, but because over time some health insurers have become so dominant that they've been able to keep competitors out. That's just the way it is. And a lot of insurers don't want to.
In fact, there was an experiment right with Georgia, wasn't there? Was it a couple of years ago where they wanted to open it up across state lines, and they found nobody wanted to come because they just couldn't make
money. Exactly, it's a funny thing because that was certainly been a Republican talking point or an idea for reform. Just let insurance companies compete across state lines. Well, the thing is, there has not been a federal prohibition against it. Number one, and number two, there's insurance companies have not been looking to go across state lines for a variety of reasons. In Georgia, it proved that it doesn't work because in the Deep South, Georgia was not able to attract any insurers from Alabama or Tennessee or South Carolina or Florida. They just weren't willing to come into the state.
I don't understand why that is. Is it because the profiles of a Georgian are so different from...
No, here's what's going on. Blue Cross of Georgia has been there quite a long time, has dominance. They are able to cut the best deals with the hospitals and the doctors. If you come in new to the market, you don't have those kinds of relationships. You don't have that kind of clout. You don't come in with a big book of customers. So you're starting at a disadvantage. And so you're not going to get the favorable rates that you... That Blue
and the
Cross
hospitals
of
see you coming, and they just see a big fat wall. Essentially.
That's right. That's
because they know you're naive as to what's going on here.
Yeah, and plus, if you come into a new state, you have to deal with the regulators in that new state. So you've got that to deal with. And they just say, well, to hell with it.
Well, Wendell, I really appreciate the new book, is Obamacare, What's in It for Me? What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act. We will put a link on majority.fm to the book. And I appreciate it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Pleasure to talk to you too, Sam. There's one thing in passing. One of my new things is to focus attention on the need to improve dental care. The Affordable Care Act doesn't do nearly enough to make sure that we have access to good dental care. So that, I want that to be on everybody's radar screen. You've got to do more as we go forward. The ACA, the Obamacare, is the end of the beginning of reform. There's a lot of opportunity for doing better, and dental care is one area.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's interesting because I have a friend who had a dentistry practice in New York City. He moved upstate, and he found sort of the not only the quality of care to be quite bad, but the culturally, people did not access dental care in the way, you know, presumably because of cost.
Yeah, it's true.
And it causes. I think people underestimate the real medical implications.
Mike, I have a column in the Huffington Post today about that very thing, about the connection between oral health and overall health. if you have bad teeth and gums, you are more likely to be a diabetic and have heart problems. Or an abscess can lead to a brain infection. It can kill you. Mm-hmm. And people don't realize the importance of having access to good oral care. And we've got to do more. People die every day because of problems that begin in their teeth and gums.
Wendell Potter, again, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break and head into the fun half of the program. We will take your phone calls. I hope we have the technology to do so. You can certainly hear sort of my cell phone interfering a little bit with the audio in the background. I will take your IMs. Phone number is 646-257-3920. We're not going to go too long in the funner half, but let me remind you that this program relies on member support, listener support, for 98-99% of its revenue. So if you have the financial means to support the program, please, by all means, majority.fm. Become a member today. You can also support this program by going to MajorityReportKickback.com. MajorityReportKickback.com. There you can click on the Amazon link, bookmark it. If you buy junk from Amazon, buy it through that link. You'll be kicking some money back. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Great company. Employee owned. Fair trade coffee. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Also, give us a review on iTunes. Check out the app at MajorityApp.com. Wendell Potter just got the app. I made him put it on his iPhone as he sat here. He's probably... I don't know, headed out of the conference hall to take it off his phone. Well, maybe not. Wait till he gets those push notifications that will sporadically come. Those push notifications that sporadically come. All right, folks. Be back in just a minute.